Hey there, guys. This week, I'm taking a break from recording Gospel of Mark teachings because some things have happened, and because of conversations I've been having with a surprising number of people, I've decided to talk about brain damage. No, that's not when people disagree with you on scripture. This is actually, you know, real brain damage. You know, whenever you or somebody you know has TIAs or mini strokes, also it's actually transient ischemic attacks, or small, medium, or massive strokes, or traumatic brain injury, which fortunately I don't have any experience with the latter two of those, thank God. But I want to explain a little bit of what's going on the inside for people who may be going through this and are feeling alone, or for people who are relatives of those who are experiencing this, and they really just don't know how to understand what's going on the inside of their loved one's brains. More than you would think, almost definitely, which is great. In most cases. But, of course, I've never had a massive stroke or a traumatic brain injury, but a lot, or at least some, of what's going on inside the brain during the healing process is going to be very similar with all these things. And by chronicling my healing process for this last one that I had last month and for others in the past, I've run into a lot of people who are able to understand themselves and family members for the first time because, well, you know, most people don't really want to discuss this. It's embarrassing to admit that something's not functioning well upstairs, although I don't really know why. Seriously. I mean, come on, think about it. Let's think about this logically. The brain can become diseased or damaged just like any other part of the body. But for some reason, there is this insane double standard in believing circles especially, that if your reproductive organs or your brain has problems, then you're cursed somehow or demon-possessed. But every other organ, okay, you're still okay with God, unless you're in some really severe culty kind of things. But it's just stupid. And frankly, it's elitist and uneducated and unmerciful. And I don't generally name call. But these people who promote this are nothing but snakes and vipers in the body, preying on those who have already been physically oppressed by illness and by injury, all right? Mental illness isn't usually demonic either, I have to say that. The brain is an incredibly complex machine, and things can legitimately get out of whack, physically and chemically, all right? Now, I had my first stroke at the age of 27 on January 7th, 1997. That's a lot of sevens, isn't it? After suffering from debilitating headaches since I was 12, so since puberty hit. Now, because I never made more than a few days worth of progesterone, something we wouldn't find out for a couple of more decades, I was estrogen dominant, and I still am, actually. And that causes blood clotting. It's also one of the many reasons why I could never carry a baby to term. I have multiple interoperable reproductive birth defects. So obviously walking around with brain damage and a barren womb means God hates me and only loves people without any brain damage and a ton of kids, right? Not so much. Although to hear some people talk, if I was fool enough to believe them, I'd sure think so. Now, but that first stroke was a shock. I was healthy, all right? I was working out every day at the gym. I had no reason, I had no, you know, family history, no nothing, that I was at work, and this is before I was a believer. This was 2 years before I was a believer. I was a total type A personality, okay? I mean, I was so type A that I was working in aerospace R&D at the age of 22, and was running my own small batch department when I was 23 on top of the R&D work I was doing, all right? I had graduated early from the University of California, Davis, with a degree in chemistry, which was severely impacted major because it was such a good program. I was scary smart and scary driven to succeed. I was also not a believer until I was 29 years old, so all that drive and determination and those brains were certainly not going to use for the sake of the kingdom. I can tell you that. Excuse me, but that first stroke, it was a pretty bad one. It's actually the worst one I ever had. What I'd call a medium stroke now, some of these side effects lasted for 20 years. And actually some of them are permanent, you know, unless God decides to revert me back to completely the way I was. But the last bit of paralysis lasted until the summer of 2017, when I finally regained the ability of my brain to fully communicate entire words to my hands. And a lot of you who know me, you've seen me do this, okay? You've just seen the, just like, come on, hand! I'd start out writing a word, and my hand would stop writing about halfway through, even though my brain kept spelling it out. And it was, no word was worse than my last name, Rosenquist. It'd get out about four or five letters, and then I would just kind of do this. It would stop. It wouldn't even do a line. It would just stop. My hand would be like, we're done now. Alright? And yeah, I can laugh about it now. It was kind of like, come on! It's like my hand was a mule and I was tugging at it, alright? I do remember right after I had that stroke, and I was at work. I had right side paralysis. I couldn't feel the skin on the right-hand side of my body, and I was actually scratching madly at the right-hand side of my face with my fingernails on my left hand. I was desperately trying to feel pain. You know, to feel anything. All right, it felt numb. The paralysis and the lack of feeling is unpleasant, okay? But compared to what was going on inside the brain, it's really only an inconvenience. At least for me. I want you to imagine being on a freeway, and there's all the regular traffic, all right? But there's an accident, a big one. That's what a blood clot in the brain is like, all right? And a bad one shuts things down for, and the ones that come after it, you know, they create a blockage. It shuts things down for a long enough time that the damage becomes more and more permanent or long-lasting. Small clots mean a short accident cleanup time, and the damage can almost always be entirely undone. But between the small and the large clots, or multiple clots, there's a lot of, you know... There you go! Can't complete my sentence. Alright, that's courtesy of the small stroke I had on April 17th, and the two mini strokes I had after that. And I could edit that out. I won't edit it out. It's life for me right now. And the really sad thing is, I'm reading it off a transcript, and I was hoping that I would be able to finish that sentence. I can't. It's just not there. So now, so it's all staying. It's sad. But back to my script here. The symptoms can vary a lot. Okay, from very mild annoyances to severe life interruptions. And you know I'm not totally sticking to the script either, right? Because rabbit trails, that's me. With the medium stroke, and because this was my first one and I didn't have God with me, I didn't think I did. Anyway, I was terrified all the time. My brain was like that freeway with a huge pileup, and things were getting cleaned up, but there was a lot of damage. Normal traffic is, you know, jammed up, some of it, but some of it can also get rerouted, you know? But the point is that the information isn't going the way it normally goes, and so that results in things taking a lot longer. Some functions just can't be rerouted. They're stuck there until everything's totally clear again, and sometimes that just never happens. You know, other stuff, well, you know, I'm going to tell you the story of when Mark and I drove down from Idaho to Zion National Park and Bryce Canyon National Park last October. So, we're heading down, and I think we were in, we're in Layton. And I wrote that down there. Boom, you know. I-15 at Layton is all torn up on the southbound lane. The entire, not just one lane, but all the lanes, all the entire southbound way. I'm driving, Mark's sleeping. It makes it easier for him to cope with my driving if he's sleeping. And I'm not kidding either. And so all the traffic gets diverted onto other roads, you know, detoured. But we aren't talking about a frontage road experience here. I like those. Those are fine. You can see the highway. It's right there. You know where you're going. You know you're headed in the right direction. But the detour turned all the heck over the place. Weird roads and everything and... And I just don't have a great sense of direction in general, but I know we weren't just headed south. We were headed east and west and oh my gosh. Sideways and slantways and, you know, all that sort of things. And you know, you're just craning your head and hoping not to miss the other detour signs, because sometimes they had us turning right and other times left, and it was a mess, and it took a long time to get back onto I-15. And I was anxious, okay? I don't like this kind of uncertainty. I was sweating bullets, and I was concerned about getting lost. That's your brain after a stroke. And you can get lost. You can run into a roadblock and get stuck. But hopefully there's just a long detour, and you're gonna, you know, get back on track. So, the brain's frustrated, and... You know, the brain is scared and confused. It's just an organ, okay? It isn't who we are. It's just an organ that our soul uses to think with, to run the body with, okay? That's how I've come to look at it. That's why smart people aren't more precious to God than people who aren't so smart. Because the soul is separate from the brain. That's why someone with Down syndrome is not second in the kingdom to a PhD. All right? Does everybody understand what I'm saying here? But just like the soul can't walk on crippled legs, it also can't think properly with a damaged brain. I'm hoping this makes sense, because this is just something I recently kind of came to this conclusion that that's how it works. Now, the end result is that the brain becomes overwhelmed and paranoid. I need for people to understand this for the sake of themselves and the sake of their loved ones going through all this. Learning not to give in to the paranoia, because the paranoia is there whether you want it to be or not, has nothing to do with... Learning not to give in to that paranoia took me many years of hard work, working with God. Without him, I don't know what I would have done. But I didn't have him the first time, and I had nothing to gauge my experiences next to. I didn't know anyone who had suffered a stroke that wasn't permanent and catastrophic. You know, you hear the horror stories, you know? No one talks about how many people are out there recovering from small strokes. Or that even with a moderate stroke, you can recover some semblance of a normal life, or the majority, okay, in my case. But I sat on the couch staring at the wall for a long time after they laid me off at work. Couldn't remember the names of the employees on my shift whom I'd known for years. Couldn't make decisions. I was exhausted all the time because my brain was just so busy healing. I have to say that this, at this point, We didn't know for a couple of months that I had had a stroke. All right, in the ER that night, they diagnosed me with a panic attack. And it wasn't until my workplace sent me to a neuropsychologist that we found out I had significant left lobe brain damage. Okay? The staff on site at the hospital that night didn't think a 27-year-old woman could have had a stroke, so they didn't even run an MRI. Despite my blood pressure being 245 over 147 when I was admitted to the ER, and I had just been prescribed birth control pills that had caused severe estrogen cascading and blood clotting. We still didn't know about my progesterone problem for 3 more years. They had paradigm. They did test me for drugs, though, because they figured, oh, she's on drugs. No, they couldn't even find aspirin in my system. Now, after a while, I did get back to work. But the problems with my brain, you know, some of them were permanent. My personality changed. I was no longer type A. Probably a positive thing, right? I also wasn't nearly as intelligent as I used to be. Still not. I could feel how hard it was to solve problems compared to before. It's still harder. I never appreciated what kind of mind I had. And don't get me wrong, I still qualify as gifted, but now I'm probably at the low end of the range and not at the higher end. Yeah, boo-hoo, right? Oh, poor Tyler. The point is that I can't mentally do the same things I used to do. And that's frustrating, because you know it's like, oh, I could have done this 20 years ago. Actually, what, 23 years ago now. I've learned to accept that, and I've learned to adapt to it. I have adapted to it, but... And really, it doesn't affect normal life, so, you know, who cares, right? But it took me a long time to learn to cope and slow down. You still want to go fast, because on the inside, you're still the same soul that you were before. But you have to adapt to a new reality. It can make you really angry. There's a lot of reason to be frustrated. You know, my husband, he really wants me to get my master's degree and PhD, but I never know when I'm going to have one of these things, and are they going to happen the day before a midterm? You know, I've had to accept my limitations, and I'm good with that. I'm good with that. But I want to talk to you about the paranoia. Because if you've had one, if you're going through one right now, then you understand. Your brain isn't your soul. I've said that before. Your brain doesn't understand, doesn't have an awareness of why it isn't working properly. It's clever enough to try and compensate where it can, but the brain is not entirely a reasoning entity. It's a thinking computer. Our brains need us to rein them in and to speak comfortingly to them. Our brains need to be reassured that they don't need to function perfectly right now and that they just need to heal. That they need to be patient and adapt. That's what people don't understand about what it's like to have a stroke, either from the inside or from the outside. Brains have to be comforted and reassured, and treated with kid gloves when they're damaged. Really? When we've had a stroke, our brains need to be treated like children. The time for being challenged is in the future, when healing starts taking place and we need to see what's improved and what hasn't. But the worst thing we can do when someone has suffered a stroke or a TBI is to behave, a traumatic brain injury, is to behave as though nothing has happened. No, you don't want to baby yourself or the other person, but you have to be smart and compassionate, and there have to be some serious reality checks. Most things, in my experience, heal. You know, most things heal, but not everything, and nothing is ever entirely as it was again unless there is divine healing. Now, fortunately, our worth isn't tied to how well our brains function any more than it's tied to the viability of our reproductive organs or any other organs for that matter. We have to learn to see the difference between ourselves and the shells that God designed for us to live in. So, I found out right away that I couldn't drive anywhere. Even once the paralysis was getting better. Why? Well, my brain wasn't healthy enough to deal with all the input. Think about how much attention to how many things is required to drive a car. Not only do you have to manually just drive the car, and I was driving a stick back then, but you have to pay attention to the road and to any possible distractions or dangers. The brain that's damaged by a stroke and even by a small one can't process that much information. So the brain starts freaking out, and that freaking out causes paranoia. The brain doesn't want you involved in such a complicated activity, and so it's going to start messing with you. I remember driving through the neighborhood. Remember, this was before I was diagnosed, after the stroke, before I was diagnosed, when I was just told it was a panic attack. And I was absolutely 100% sure that there were people ducked down in the cars alongside the road who were going to suddenly swerve into me. Absolutely certain. Oddly enough, I believe my brain was simply just trying to get me stop driving. I'll never know for sure. But when I have strokes now, and I try to do my normal routine, the same thing always happens. I've learned coping mechanisms, but I've also learned to respect my brain telling me that we just can't do this right now. It's not about giving into paranoia. It's about having a healthy respect for why my brain is doing all it can to induce that sort of irrational fear. I have to see what's behind the fear. The reality of just being impaired for a while. And know that the impairment will pass, or at least some of it will, but I can't do anything about it either way. And I can do what needs to be done maybe in the future, or maybe recognize that it really can just slide for a while, or somebody else can do it for a change. That's a toughie. But I've learned not to be hard on myself or to consider myself to be useless or hopeless or stupid or cursed or whatever. I have a physical problem that causes my blood to clot. Actually, there are quite a few underlying causes, and I've learned to compensate for some of them. I've learned not to eat meat and milk within 4 hours of each other, and because that can be tricky, in January I just stopped eating dairy at all. I take aspirin and turmeric, and I have a special medication that opens up the blood vessels in my brain so that when I do clot, they're more likely to pass through than to clump up and cause problems. And when sometimes doing these things just isn't enough, like last month and we still aren't sure what happened after going 15 months without anything more than the two TIAs that were my own fault because I made some mistakes in my self-care, you know, fortunately those only last for up to 24 hours and they're gone like they never happened. This is my life. We all have something, right? This is just a little bit more dramatic than some things, but nothing's ever really kept me from serving God. What it does do is give other people the chance to serve God by caring for me. You know, when I'm going through this. And I think that's just something we miss because we don't like feeling we're burdens. My infirmities are chances for those around me to be sheep instead of goats. Are they going to shun me and consider me stricken? You know, that sounded like Isaiah 53, which should never be applied to me. Are they going to consider me stricken by God, or are they going to see me as an opportunity to serve God by taking care of me when I'm down for the count? To stop making demands. Our job in this life, our purpose for being here, isn't just to be on the top and taking care of everyone else, but to set an example by humbly allowing others to take care of us when we need it. How else will they learn to be other-centered if we stubbornly refuse to allow them to assist us when we need it? Anyway, be back in just a few minutes with part two. Hi, this is Tyler Dawn Rosenquist, and I think I forgot to say the first half. And this is Character in Context, where we normally talk about being conformed to the character Messiah, and I guess we're talking about that this week, too, in a big way. I just haven't really mentioned it, but for those of you who are just tuning in now, I'm talking about brain injury and stroke. And how we need to cut ourselves a lot of slack, and I've been trying to explain how stroke or TIAs feel like from the inside. Of course, I can't be exhaustive. This is only, you know, this is a short program. But if you did miss part of the program, this will be up on my podcast channel, characterincontext.podbean.com, on Friday. It'll also be up on my blog, theancientbridget.com, along with a transcript that will not contain my rabbit trails, because who has time to go back through and put those in? Anyway, so I just talked about how it's very easy for us to feel when our brains are not functioning on all cylinders to feel like burdens, okay? But it's an opportunity for those around us to serve God by serving us. And that's very difficult for somebody like me, who wants to be the person who is giving and doing and being the one, you know, who is sacrificing and not the person who is the recipient. That was very demoralizing for me for a long time, but I've had to learn to get over myself and my arrogant pride. And then stroke's a good way for that to happen. Anyway, so, people have had strokes. I want you to know they're not stupid or insensible. We can be hurt very deeply, right? We can feel love. We can be scared and we can feel safe. We can feel overwhelmed and we can be restful. And I'm going to tell you something. We can switch from one to another at the drop of a hat. In a lot of ways, we're just like everyone else. Just because our inside thoughts might not be able to manifest in concrete action on the outside doesn't mean there isn't a thinking human being, precious human being, on the inside. Sometimes our thoughts are normal and just don't make their way to the surface. We might tell ourselves to walk down the hall, but we don't know where the wall is because our vision centers aren't quite copacetic at the moment. That's why I'm generally bruised up and down one side or the other after a stroke. It looked like, well, no, I guess if it was on the left side, it would look like Mark beat me up because he's right-handed. Fortunately, it's on the right side. The parts of us that can walk might just be fine, but we don't quite have a good bead on where our body is with respect to the corner of the wall. Maybe our long, medium, or short-range vision is impaired. Maybe all three of them are. Maybe only one. You see, it all depends on where the clot happened and how severe it is. I have never, ever been unable to type. And I thank God for that mercy. That would be really hard for me. Sometimes my ability to think clearly about what to write might be impaired, and a lot of times it is, but I can always at least express what I'm thinking. Just sometimes my thoughts aren't always so inspirational or organized as usual. Anyway, I really hope this makes sense to people. And I really hope it helps people to sort of relate to a loved one who is trapped inside a system that really isn't working for them anymore, or is going through it themselves. You aren't worthless. It just takes time and a need and a willingness to adapt and to accept what you can't change or can't be changed right now. It might very well change in the future. If we handle it right, We will never have a better opportunity to grow in our relationship with God, because there are very few times when we are more vulnerable than after a stroke. You know, we have no choice but to lean on God and to lean on others. If we can accept it with humility, it's fertile soil for the growing of really good fruit and developing compassion for others. If we wallow in bitterness and anger, it can be the worst thing to ever happen to us. But it's wonderful, okay, in the aftermath of a stroke, learning who our God really is. I mean, until something terrible happens, His goodness is nothing to us except theoretical. And, you know, being a mom of a special needs son with who has lower than average IQ, all right? I don't know how I could have been his mom as the total brainiac that I was before my stroke, and have any compassion whatsoever about how hard it would be for him to learn and to grasp things. And I have had to accept him where he is while, you know, not really allowing him to skate on some things that he can do better. And he knows darn well he could do better, but he doesn't want to. And then there are some things that he can do, like, are amazing, and you wouldn't think. It's like the neuropsychologist told us. If Andrew didn't have problems with his brainstem, problems with his mathematical and logical functions, he would have an above average IQ. In some areas, he is just very gifted, intelligence-wise. He's got a great memory for facts and figures. I know if he ever became a Bible scholar, he'd be a really, really good one. And, you know, but I don't know if that's his path. I hope that's his path, but I don't know. And he's got some work to do before he would be having the maturity to do that, and God has some work to do before he has the desire to do that. But he does actually have brain damage, my son Andrew. That doesn't mean he's stupid. That doesn't mean there aren't things that he can do and ways he can serve the body. It doesn't define his worth. Anyway. All right, so I wanted to share, I had this dream, and you know, some of you are going, oh my gosh, dreams, but if you know me, you know my dreams are always corrective dreams for me, and then I share them. I don't dream about apocalyptic stuff that's going to happen, and you know, and all that kind of stuff. I have dreams where God has to get in a word edgewise sometime, and my brain's always going a mile a minute, and it's hard for him to reach me except in the middle of the night. So I'm not proud of that. But he gave me a dream. I dreamed a parable the other night, and I hope this is going to encourage somebody, okay? Give you kind of a picture of who our God is, and maybe a different way to relate to him. So I call this the parable of the snake who escaped. Yeah, sometimes I dream in parables and they take me a few days to figure out. This is no exception. Last week I had a dream about being in the wilderness. Boy, let's just get really thick and heavy with the with the biblical thematic stuff, and especially teaching about the Gospel of Mark and Yeshua. Jesus just keeps going to the wilderness to be alone with God over and over and over again. So I'm in the wilderness with my husband and some others, and there were vipers everywhere. Again, with the heavy-handed biblical thing, right? But specifically copperheads. Now, when I say the copperheads were everywhere, I am not exaggerating. I mean, I'm not talking Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, pit full of cobras, all laying on top of each other, everywhere. Okay, I mean, what did they eat down there anyway? Not like mice would be stupid enough to go down into the pit with the cobras, and why would they even go down? There's no reason, you know, but I digress. I'm pretty sure that wasn't a documentary. This is like my father-in-law. We were watching a silly fictional movie. He goes, wow, this is a really interesting documentary. And he is kidding. He is kidding. That's his joke. But, you know, it was quite the accomplishment to avoid all these copperheads while you're walking around, because they're the same color as the ground. You know, so there was that additional challenge as well. Now, I went to the garage, and yes, there was a garage in the wilderness. This is a dream, not a documentary. And I tried to round up some axes so that we could all chop up the snakes. Dreams, right? But when I came back, my husband tells me that he's taken care of 99% of the copperheads. They were gone, which I just assumed meant they were dead. You know, that never came up again. So, now, what was my response? Was I thrilled that 99% of the copperheads were gone? Was I rejoicing? Was I complimenting him on a job well done? No. I was freaking out because of the snake who escaped while my husband tried to show me that, you know, my bed was free of them anyway, okay? He was lifting up the bedding, my pillows, and showing me there were no copperheads in the bed. And I'm looking, I'm going, where's the other snake? Now, it's funny now, a few days later, but I had to go through a few days, you know, to see what was going on. Now, you probably already got the punchline because, like, you know, our forays into the gospel, you had a narrator giving you some important prompts. The disciples, on the other hand, you know, experienced the gospels. They experienced Yeshua's ministry without a narrator, and I experienced the dream the same way. So, you know, I woke up and I groaned, oh no! You see, God's been giving me these heads-up dreams for the last 16 years. Whenever I was about to be betrayed or go through a terrible trial instigated by somebody else's treachery. In those dreams, there are always three things in common. One, the presence of my husband or another male authority figure whom I trust, even if it's just a nameless, faceless person who I don't really know, but it's, you know, it's a guy. Two, a terrible disaster, which comes in the form of an attack. Now, the first time this happened, it was a nuclear attack, which is a good way to describe what ended up happening in real life short time later, all right? Okay, and three, I am kept supernaturally safe in these dreams, although I have to live through the unpleasant consequences of the attack. So, I figure this is one of those. Immediately, that's where my mind went, and I waited. And nothing happened. And usually, something generally happens in fairly short order. So, you know, I took my interpretation of the dream back to the drawing board, and although something might still be in the wings, another attack, betrayal, or whatever that I have to endure quietly while God keeps me safe and deals with it himself. And, you know, so I start looking at the dream again. I go back. Now, obviously, my husband was representative of God as protector and provider in my life. I figured that one out years ago when these dreams started happening. That one was just too obvious. I had assumed I would be facing a trial where God took care of 99% of the fallout, maybe, or protected me from 99% of the incoming attacks. That was my assumption. But the use of the 100 and the 99 and the 1, it occurred to me that there were some very significant parallels with the parable of the lost sheep. And how all of heaven rejoiced when just one lost sheep was found. And here I was, okay, here I was, full of anxiety, when only one snake escaped. Okay, now how much greater would the rejoicing in heaven be if 99 lost sheep were found? Well, how thrilled I should be, right? Then that that I'm protected from the 99 and only one solitary percent of the snakes who are still out there. But once I figured this out, you know, I start laughing my head off. Mostly at myself and my anxiety-riddled mindset. Now, if I had lived with that sort of fear of copperheads when we lived in Missouri, I wouldn't have ever left the house, much less gone trampling around our 33 acres, you know, picking wild blackberries and raspberries, and we wouldn't have a bunch of jam in the basement still. Yeah, I assume the worst, just like in my dream. You know, in fact, and here's the really cool thing, because I thought I had a really good bead on what all those other dreams had been telling me because, you know, I'd been through them, they'd come to pass, I'd seen it every time he told me to keep my mouth shut and let him handle it. I had, for the most part. And I thought, well, I have a bit, pretty good bead on the message behind these dreams. But God was reaching back 16 years and showing me something about every single one of those dreams that I had missed, with the exception of one time 5 years ago when I actually did get it. The point of the warning dreams wasn't in the warning, okay? It was in the assurance that I would be divinely protected. We are all going to go through trials and betrayals, every single one of us. Sure, yours might not be as public as some of mine have been, but we all endure such things. And do you even know what I'm talking about? I bet you don't. Why? Because I allowed God to handle them. I didn't go on my Facebook wall saying, oh, I'm being persecuted for the truth. Oh my gosh, this person did this and that, and I'm so humiliated, and they shouldn't have done that, and they're lying about me. No. No. You didn't hear about it. You didn't know what happened. And you know what? Because I didn't say anything, God was able to really, really clean up the mess a whole lot easier. But anyway, you know, I want you to look back over the times when you've had to endure trials. You know, how have you been carried, shielded, and protected from the consequences, what the consequences would have been without him? Okay? There are people in our lives who are going to do their best to harm us. God doesn't stop people from sinning when they have their hearts really set on him. He doesn't stop us, does he? When we're really, really, really determined not to listen. You know, even with believers, sometimes their agendas and pride and bad fruit and ego, oh my gosh, don't even get me started on ego, just blind them to what they're really doing and how destructive they're being to the kingdom. And actually, I've got a series that I've been doing on this on my blog, theancientbridge.com. It's called The Seven Deadly Hang-Ups. And all of the seven deadly hang-ups lead to the kind of things where we attack and harm others. So if you want to catch that. But just because he doesn't stop people from sinning against us doesn't mean he leaves us at the mercy of the wolves or the vipers. I can't think of any betrayal or attack I have been faced with that couldn't have been 100 times worse. Looking back, it's obvious that I'm protected, not from the initial attack, but from the severity of what the long-term consequences could have been under different circumstances. But all of these dreams and all of these betrayals, I had to allow God to handle them and to refuse to lash out publicly. I have found that he does not protect me from the consequences of my interference with what he is doing in the midst of a crisis when he has warned me to trust him and be silent. I made the mistake once of not remaining silent. I mean, I wasn't like saying anything publicly, but I was saying things behind the scenes to people whom I found out I shouldn't have been saying it to. All right. And I found out very quickly that people are much more apt to side with the villain when the victim of a non-criminal offense, all right? But just sin, all right? Starts making a big fuss and starts throwing a monkey wrench into established relationships. It's not logical, and it's not right, but it's true. People want your problems to remain your problems, and especially within friendship groups. They don't want to have to choose, all right? That's why we got to allow God to handle it. Because people, when forced to choose, will generally choose the wrong side, all right? Anyway, all of that is why he showed me that there were no snakes in my bed. Back to this, okay? He needed to show me that I could rest in his deliverance and not worry about the snake who had escaped his wrath, all right? That snake didn't really escape his wrath. Well, I mean, he chose not to do anything about that snake because it's important that we have snakes out there. It's important that we know that there are snakes out there. I needed to know that that snake was there so I would remember to cling to him. And not focus on it. You know, but you know, so you think about the snake. The snake's there. You cling to God because the snake's there, but you don't focus on the snake's there. You focus on God, who you cling to because the snake is there. Because if you're focusing on the snake, rather than the 99% that were eliminated, oh man, it's just a huge mistake. And I guess what it all comes down to is, who do we trust? Are we grateful for the things that we have been spared that, you know, we just don't even have a clue about? Or are we resentful about the one snake that gets through that we have to deal with? Because I'll tell you something, we really treat God very unfairly. Can I get an amen? We're horrible, okay? Other people are going through things, and we say, oh, I'll just be thinking about you. Don't forget to be grateful for what you have, and this could all be so much worse, and I am so sorry for what you're going through. Be thinking good thoughts about you and praying for you, and then when something happens to us, boy, howdy are we howling, right? Well, now it's unfair. Why is God doing this to me? Am I not being faithful? Am I not observing the commandments? Am I not this? Am I not that? I didn't deserve this to have Well, did the other person deserve it? The whole point about snakes is that they bite indiscriminately. They bite whoever's close. They bite whoever they perceive as a threat. Some snakes, like cottonmouths, they just come right after you and they are just spiteful. I was glad it was not a copperhead in my, I mean, not cottonmouth in my dream, or I might have just had a heart attack. Not woken up, never. Ooh, I hate cottonmouths. Used to live in Texas, and I just, dang. Oh, they just, you see one coming from the other side of, oh, you just run. You just run. Anyway, I just totally got off on a little tangent there. But we have to, if we're not overly concerned when other people go through trials, then we should not be overly concerned when we go through them. If we're telling people that God still loves them, then we need to tell, you know, ourselves the same thing. If we're telling other people to be grateful for what they have, then we need to be grateful for what we have. Trials teach us our areas of hypocrisy. In my case, trials have taught me that I tend to focus on the one snake that remains while ignoring the 99 that were, well, they're gone. We just don't know what happened. Evidently, it wasn't important, and I'm on a need-to-know basis, and I did not need to know. But be back next week, and back with the Gospel of Mark. Y'all take care. Thank you.
Thank you.